Hi, and welcome to the start of our third season about how tech is shaping politics and society across the world. We've talked about privacy before in lots of different contexts in this show. In our series on work, we talked about privacy protections for workers' data, and we've also talked, for example, about facial recognition. Now, this show isn't primarily about politics, but without support from political institutions, from representatives and leaders, legislation on issues like privacy just doesn't happen. When it comes to debates about privacy in the US, legislation can be made at both the state and the federal level, meaning that these political battles rage not only in Washington DC, but also in each state. Joining me to make sense of all of this hodgepodge is my guest today, who has extensive experience at both the state and federal level as a journalist and a privacy activist. I should say, just as a side note, that we recorded this in the last week of September. It's been the campaign season in the US since then, and from what I can tell, there has been no significant change on the status of the two privacy bills mentioned in this episode. Without further ado, here's my guest. I'll let her introduce herself.
So hi, my name is Haley Tsukayama. I am senior legislative activist at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. That is a title that makes a lot of sense internally, but not always a lot of sense externally. So EFF has three main teams, one of which is the activism team, which I'm a part of, which is really about getting our messaging out about digital rights and advancing civil liberties in the digital age to as many people as possible. That is EFF's core goal, is to advance civil liberties in the digital age, particularly around issues such as privacy, freedom of expression, and innovation. As a legislative activist, as you can probably imagine, I work with legislatures. Particularly, I get to work with state legislatures here in the US, which is pretty cool, especially on the privacy front. States have really been leading the way in the US, more so than the federal government. And so I've had a very exciting few years. I also kind of co-lead our internal consumer privacy working group, so I get to think about consumer privacy a lot.
That sounds really interesting, and I'm excited to talk about states a little bit later on. Just firstly, in terms of your own background, you used to be a journalist at the Washington Post, and I'm interested how you got into your current line of work from that. What kind of brought you there?
Yeah, so I'll step back a little, which is I always wanted to be a journalist. The way that I got interested in sort of tech policy journalism was as an intern in Washington, D.C. in about 2009-2010. I got to cover the healthcare debate, which in America, Obamacare, you know, that's often what people call it. And I became really interested in sort of this idea of health data and privacy. And the US's health data law, HIPAA, is fairly narrow. It only applies to certain like types of companies that hold health data. So the same health data that I might submit on a Fitbit, you know, like what my temperature was throughout the day or something like that, has almost no protections under US law. But if I gave that same, if my doctor took that same information, or if I was taking that information from my doctor, it would be protected. I found that really interesting. I thought privacy was a very interesting concept. And so that's how I got into being interested about tech policy. Once you dig into health privacy, other privacy follows. So an interest in privacy brought me into my specific part of journalism. I was a tech reporter. I covered, you know, all the large companies. And at some point, after about almost 8 years at the Post, I was getting really sick of covering what I felt was sort of the same story over and over again about the way that these companies aren't respecting our privacy, about the way they're using data, the way they're collecting data, the ways that they're just completely missing, out of step with consumer expectations. And, but, you know, as a journalist, you're really, especially in the US, especially at somewhere like the Post, you're supposed to be really measured and objective. And of course, you can make some editorial decisions with the stories you choose to cover. But I found myself really wanting to advocate for policy change in a way that was no longer appropriate for my job. So I talked to the folks at EFF a bunch of times for articles. I saw on Twitter that they had a posting for legislative activists, and I thought, well, if my frustration is that I don't get to have opinions, that job is essentially full-time having opinions. So I applied, and I was lucky enough that they were willing to hire me. So that's how I got here.
That's a great story. And in terms of privacy, there are some people who say who don't really care that much about privacy and would say, well, why is privacy that important? You know, I don't really care if Facebook or whatever big company has my data. But why do you think that privacy is important?
That's a great question. So I think privacy conceptually is important, right? There are things about, you know, no matter what people say about, oh, I don't care about my privacy, you still probably wouldn't be super happy if a stranger walked into your living room. So there are still some boundaries that I think around privacy that everybody maintains, you know, theoretically in their minds. When it comes to online privacy, it's harder for people to conceptualize sometimes, but, you know, honestly, it's the same sort of idea, right? It's somebody coming into a space that you probably think is safe or not monitored, and taking information about that space and then using it in ways that you wouldn't expect. So the collection is unexpected, the use is unexpected. And in terms of what harm that provides, or what harm that puts out, as opposed to, you know, just the idea of the violation, which to me is itself not great. But in terms of harms, the way that the sort of data economy works right now, the way that they use that information, you know, information about sort of what you may be buying or where you may be, that can have a lot of unintended consequences. So particularly if you're thinking about something like location data, where we go reveals a lot about who we are, who we associate with, and of course, you know, physically where we are. And if you're worried about your physical safety, if you're in a domestic violence situation or something like that, you know, that has real consequences. Even things that are a little harder to conceptualize, like what you purchase, right? And how that may, how that information may get around. You know, if that information is sold to data brokers, you know, to people who buy data and really like their whole job is to take all of this data across the internet and try and make a profile and try and re-identify people, you know, a lot of what you may be doing, even if you think it's pretty innocent, and you think, I wouldn't mind if somebody knew that, can be used in ways that are actively harmful. So, you know, if you are not white, for example, in the US, and your browsing history indicates that, that could get back to a data broker who may use that to give you a higher interest rate on a loan, or it may contribute to a profile that denies you a business loan that you've been looking for, just because of the way that their algorithm may work. So there are a lot of ways that privacy feeds into other issues, right? I've mentioned offhand racial discrimination. I've mentioned offhand domestic violence. These are sort of some of the harms that we point to. In general, I just feel like the main problem with privacy right now is that they are taking information without asking, and then they are using that information without asking, at least in the US. So, you know, I think at a fundamental level, you know, people should be upset that that their lives are being mined and used this way without really any control and very little transparency.
That was a really clear answer. Thank you so much. So one of the most striking examples that received really quite good coverage in the news recently has been all about with the revocation of Roe versus Wade. There's a lot of worry about the use of data from period tracking apps and things like that, and how that could be used potentially to prosecute women for abortions. And there have been some legislative attempts to prevent that from happening. There's something called the My Body, My Data Act. Could you tell us a bit about what that's trying to do?
Sure. So you're absolutely right that abortion and reproductive rights has become sort of a terrible use case for kind of explaining to people why privacy is so important. So, you know, American women American people had a right to an abortion here in the States for a very long time, and that has now been rolled back. They've thrown it back to the States. And as a consequence, there are a lot of people who are at risk of prosecution that weren't before. And so what My Body, My Data seeks to do, and we were happy to work on this bill with Representative Jacobs from here in California, a congressional representative. And what it does is it really seeks to limit the amount of information that companies can collect on you in the first place, to make sure that, you know, they aren't collecting information that isn't related to whatever service they're providing. And so if they don't need to know, for example, where I've been, if they don't need my location information to provide me the service, then they shouldn't collect my location information. And it also seeks to give people, you know, some basic rights, again, on, you know, sort of knowing what information companies have on them, being able to correct that information, being able to delete that information. These are all, like, pretty, they sound like pretty basic data rights, but at a federal level, they aren't rights that Americans have. And the idea behind it is, of course, as you were saying, you know, to avoid having companies collect information that could then be used in prosecutions against people who are seeking abortions or really, you know, any reproductive health, because I think we're gonna see a lot of conflation of, you know, terminating pregnancies versus other, you know, miscarriages or other types of reproductive health. So that's kind of what this bill aims to do. It's focused primarily at companies that collect anything that could be considered as reproductive health data or anything that could you could draw inferences from. You know, you could like say, oh, you know, again, if I had a fitness tracker and it noticed that I was, you know, waddling more and more over a period of 8 or 9 months, they could maybe infer that I was pregnant, or, you know, more probably more likely things about your body temperature or things like that. So even if it wasn't a product I bought for the use of tracking a pregnancy, they could still make guesses about that. So yeah, that's what we're trying to do with that bill. I think data minimization is really important, you know, kind of making that limit up front, because companies can't turn over what they don't have. And I also think being able to ask for deletion is really important in that context, too, for the same reason, but, you know, just on the other end.
And do you think that law is, are you hopeful about the chances for that?
So, I mean, we're always hopeful. We live in hope. I think it will be a difficult bill to get through the U.S. Senate in particular, because the balance between Republicans and Democrats is much closer in the Senate. You have to get a lot of folks on board before you can pass a bill. But, you know, I think it's bringing up good conversation. Of course, I would love to see it pass. We're also hoping that, you know, states at the state level may start to look at passing similar bills if the federal push doesn't happen.
That's a perfect segue into my next set of questions. So tell me about this state privacy laws. Like, who's got good state privacy? Where do we have very few privacy laws? Give me a little rundown.
Sure. Important to know that federally we have almost no privacy laws, which is why states are important, right? So we have no kind of basic GDPR style law, no broad privacy law. What we've done here in the US is pass what they call sectoral privacy laws. So we have a law governing health data, which I referenced earlier. We have a couple of laws around financial privacy, right? Credit card transactions, you know, loan applications, that kind of thing. And we have, you know, kind of various hodgepodgey laws like driving records or like rentals from video stores, that sort of thing at the federal level. But once you step outside of those very particular areas, sort of no protections at all at the federal level. So that's prompted states to step up a little bit. I don't know that there's any state, honestly, that I would consider having a really good privacy law, but probably the best one is in California, where I live, the California Consumer Privacy Act. It's a broad law. It covers most businesses. There are quite a few exemptions, but, you know, if they're covered by another one of those privacy laws, they are often exempted. If they're a small business that isn't collecting a lot of information, they're exempted. But generally speaking, it's supposed to apply to most California businesses. And it sets up some very basic rights, some of the ones I described before. So a right to know what companies have collected about you, a right to delete that information, and a right to ask them to opt out of the sale of your information if they're selling it. I mean, it does other stuff too, but from a consumer perspective, those are sort of the big three. So you can now send these requests. To me, it's a really good first step. I think you can't act on company behavior without knowing what they have, or without knowing if they sell, or without knowing those sorts of things. So it's certainly a really important law, and it has gone further than any of the other states that have passed privacy laws. So since California passed in 2018, I believe, and went into effect a year later, we've seen laws pass in Virginia, Colorado, Connecticut, and Utah. All of those substantially weaker, I think, than California's law. So, you know, there's been a bit of a flurry of activity around privacy, but it is a type of law in advocacy that, that gets a lot of pushback, mainly from businesses. And it is difficult to overcome some of those economic arguments that that businesses bring to legislatures when they say, this is too much regulation, it's going to put us out of business. Even if that is not strictly true, it is a argument that holds a lot of water with politicians. So we've seen a lot of opposition, both from, you know, big tech companies and their trade groups, but also from smaller businesses, including smaller businesses that often wouldn't actually be subject to the law, but are still worried nevertheless.
I'm interested by that list because it seems to me like a whole, it's a real range of every kind of US state, really, isn't it? It's California, you've got Utah, which is a Republican state, you've got Connecticut on the other side of the country. There's no correlation between political party or anything like that that I can see going on there. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, it's one thing I really think is interesting about privacy is, even though it doesn't always translate into being able to pass good stuff, it is really, truly a bipartisan issue. I think it taps into, you know, I think if you're talking to more liberal politicians, they're really interested in hearing about, you know, how data feeds into racial injustice. They were interested in kind of hearing about, you know, those kinds of disparities, about that, like, that base harm of privacy violation. You talk to conservative lawmakers, they also have this strain of, like, leave me alone, right? They want government to be hands-off, and so, or government or companies. You know, I think we've seen a real, they always call it the tech lash, right? Like a real pushback against the sort of practices of these large tech companies. And that has fed into sort of this conservative feeling of, you know what, we don't want these guys looking at what we're doing either. And so it kind of taps into that, you know, in the US, we call it like a libertarian streak of just like, leave me alone. And I have the right to be left alone. So it is interesting, you know, to see what arguments play with who, but, I mean, they're all in that particular way. I agree with all of them. So.
And can you identify anything that does kind of tie all those states together? Was there kind of a common strategy that worked in terms of pushing privacy, or I don't know?
Well, I mean, the funny thing is that we actually opposed a lot of those laws because they were weak. I think in terms of like being optimistic and things about privacy, I do think that they heard a lot from their constituents. I think that in a lot of those states, not all of them, but in a lot of those states, there is like a particular industry. So in Connecticut, a lot of insurance companies are based in Connecticut. In Virginia, a lot of the federal government based around in and around Virginia, and a lot of cloud companies are based in and out of Virginia. And so there are a lot of informed citizens who had a lot of opinions about what privacy law should look like. Of course, there are also strong lobbyists against privacy law in both those places. But, you know, I do think that there were just some people who were able to grasp it a little more quickly in both those states for various reasons. I also, you know, quite frankly, the model of law, the weaker model of law that we saw passed in Virginia and other places, was pushed by a number of big tech companies, including Microsoft and Amazon. And so for whatever reason, you know, they chose those states, or, you know, maybe they pitched all the states and those were the people who bit. But it is kind of, it's kind of interesting. Utah was also an interesting case. I think there was a real desire in Utah to protect privacy in some way and balance it with business interest. So I think there was sort of a hope that they could come up with a new model that everyone would be happy with. But unfortunately, it ended up pretty weak, in my opinion.
And it seems to be interesting that California is both kind of the leader, if you like, in the US, and also the home of the tech companies, which you would assume have their own sets of lobbies.
Yeah, it is. I mean, California legislature is so interesting. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, so California is, you know, one of the largest state, I mean, by population. So has a lot of clout, right? They're considering a lot of, considering the interests of a lot of people. And also, I think, thinks of itself as being sort of a frontier for legislation, particularly around tech, because they can argue, no, we understand how this works a little more, or at least they have access to people and understand how it works a little bit more. And so I think does have a real interest as a legislature in being a leader, and in as much as it can, standing up for individual people. That said, as you would imagine, the lobbying arms of the tech companies are very strong in the California legislature. They spend a lot of money there. And so I do think that, I mentioned kind of before, that the tech lash of, you know, people becoming very wary of sort of what Facebook and Google want and what they're doing, I think has really, in some ways, helped privacy laws at least get further than they used to. You know, it's really interesting for me because when I started as a tech reporter at the Post in, you know, 2010 or 2011, it was very much a posture of, we can't regulate these companies. They're the only thing driving the new American economy. They don't want to be regulated. Like, they can just kind of make their own rules. And, you know, that was sort of really the idea. That was certainly the message that those companies were bringing to Congress, and one that they were listening to. And I think after a couple of big stories, after Snowden, after a couple of big breaches, after these companies really, and I think after people kind of recognized the way that Cambridge Analytica, right, the way that they play a role in elections and in the shaping of public opinion, there was a real pushback then against, oh, maybe we gave them too much power. Maybe we should have regulated them a little more. Maybe we should think about it. And so there has been an overall shift, I think, in among the way that politicians at the state and federal level are thinking about tech companies and recognizing that they have enormous power and just trying to figure out how to pull that in. So they've lost a little bit of clout in California. I think it's made people open to having those laws at all. But they do still get considerable input in how they're written and how they're ultimately passed.
And we'll move to the national level now. We'll talk about the actual legislation in a second, but it's kind of a strange situation that the US is basically the home of all of the tech companies, all the major tech companies, and yet is very far behind when it comes to legislation. We talk about the Brussels effect, so most of the leading legislation comes from Europe. It doesn't come from the US. Why do you think the US is so slow on this?
I think particularly on privacy, one issue is that privacy is not explicitly recognized as a right in the US. It's inherent. It's sort of like, you can see what they're getting at in things like our Fourth Amendment, which is against unreasonable searches and seizures, you know, in sort of the right not to testify against yourself in a court case, that sort of thing. But, you know, there is no, like, there is a right to privacy. Whereas my understanding is in the EU, it's a recognized human right. It's just like not even a debate. And so I think that's a big piece of it, right? I think having that grounding, that agreement of saying, okay, like this is a human right and it is something that we have to protect, is a big difference. I also think, I mean, there are a lot of ways that American governance is different from EU governance, but, companies have a very strong voice in American governance. And so, if you're talking about new regulation, especially regulation that applies to such a broad group of companies, you get a lot of pushback. It's a lot of discussion that has to happen. Things get mired down in debate. And so, that's a function of American democracy. I also think, one right that we do have here in America is a freedom of expression, freedom of speech. It's the First Amendment. It's very important, and it's a much different interpretation than you see in Europe. And so there are some arguments about companies having First Amendment rights to do certain types of data collection, companies having certain rights to have to be protected against bans on certain types of use of data collection. And so it's just a much different legal framework that we have to consider. And in that way, it slows us down quite a bit.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, actually. So then at the federal level, we've talked about how there's no actual federal laws that exist to protect privacy, really. But there are attempts at the moment to do exactly that. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, so right now there is a bill called the America Data Privacy Protection Act, or the ADPPA, or ADPA. We'll see which thing I call it as we talk about it. It is an attempt at a federal comprehensive data privacy bill. We are neutral on it, neutral-leaning critical on it. So I'll say that up front. It does have a lot of good provisions, right? I think it is definitely better than any version of a privacy bill I have seen come out of Congress since I started covering tech policy in 2010. So a lot of privacy advocates are supportive of it outside of us. They've done clearly a lot of work to try and get politicians to come to some better position than they used to be, which is, having their fingers in their ears about privacy being an issue at all. But we do have some concerns with the bill, which are mostly related to sort of, as I've been talking about, states have really been thinking about this and being a little bit more proactive on passing laws. And it would in many ways limit their ability to do that in the future, because it would, as a federal law, sometimes federal laws can say, well, we're federal, so we're going to override all of your individual state laws to make one sort of national regime. Sometimes that can work. In privacy, historically, we've gone the other way. We've had a baseline federal standard that states can build on. So in the issue of medical privacy, for example, there's a baseline federal law, and then many states have passed their own kind of strengthening laws to build on top of it. So that is the kind of model we'd prefer to see.
And again, are you hopeful with this one? I mean, maybe not hopeful because you're kind of quite critical of it, but where do you think this is going?
It had a lot, so I learned long ago that trying to predict what Congress is going to do is a fool's errand. But I think this bill had a lot of momentum 3 or 4 months ago. I haven't heard as much about it lately. So I think, it made it through a pretty key committee in our lower house in the House of Representatives. It hasn't gone for a full floor vote in the House of Representatives. The clock is tick-ticking. I think the session is supposed to end this week before they head out onto the campaign trail for elections in November. So I don't know that we're going to see action on it. I mean, I never say never, but I don't know that we're going to see action on it before elections are over. in what they call here a lame duck session, which is a session populated by people who may have lost their seats. So I don't expect fast movement on it. I think, you know, they have done a lot to, part of our issue with it is they've done a lot to try and make it as palatable to as broad a group of people as possible. So it has had a lot of kind of support, but whether that translates into votes is going to be an interesting question, because I do think that, you know, states, particularly California, that already have laws on the books that are stronger in ways than the federal bill, are not particularly happy with the idea of losing their state bill.
And do the same kind of political dimensions apply? Is it similarly bipartisan as at the state level?
Yeah, actually, so this part of what makes this bill interesting is that it is the first, like, approaching reasonable bill that we've seen from a bipartisan, you know, from bipartisan authors. And so, you know, as I said earlier, especially to get through the Senate, you need bipartisan support in the U.S. right now. And so having a Republican co-sponsor and a Democratic co-sponsor is really important. You know, again, I do think that some Republicans, even Republicans I don't agree with on many other issues, do recognize the value of privacy. So it's really just a question of how strictly are they going to want to regulate businesses? And particularly for us, this is sort of a tangent, but enforcement is really important. You know, you can write a lovely bill that promises the moon, but if you don't have any way to enforce it, then you've essentially written nothing at all. And that is sort of where the sticking point is often, right? Because businesses obviously do not want to be subject to strong scrutiny from regulators. They don't. They really don't want our favorite enforcement mechanism, which is individual lawsuits for violations of privacy. And these things become sticking points, particularly, you know, that's where conservatives and liberals really differ, I find, in these debates, is that liberals are more okay with kind of strong enforcement, and conservatives tend to want to give businesses more wiggle room.
That's really interesting. And then just finally, I know you don't want to make predictions, but do you remain hopeful? I mean, maybe we're not going to get to GDPR levels in the US anytime soon, but are you hopeful that there's a lot of progress that can be made in the US on privacy?
Yes, I am. I mean, honestly, if I didn't have hope, this job would be terrible. you know, to try to just go and dash myself against the rocks every year. I do have hope. I mean, I think I went through my own kind of my own kind of era of privacy nihilism near the end of my journalism career, when I was like, it's just the same stuff, we're never going to make any progress. I mean, they introduced, the last time there was a bipartisan vehicle for privacy in Congress, I was still a young reporter. I think it was probably 2011 or 2012 with John McCain and John Kerry when they were both in the Senate. So, and you know, ever since then, every year it was like, no, this is the year we're going to pass comprehensive federal privacy law. And it's like, well, I will believe that when I see it. But I do think that the conversation has changed a lot since then. I think individual people sort of recognize better what privacy harms come from, you know, from having no regulations on privacy. And I think just the way that tech has become a deeper part of our lives has helped people kind of understand the technical aspects of it. So I do see a lot more sort of, you know, individuals or citizens groups interested in privacy. Particularly now we're seeing a lot of interest from, you know, in the pandemic, a lot of kids had to do remote school. There's a lot of interest in student privacy, right? A lot of workers were subjected to more surveillance. There's a lot of interest in worker privacy. So we're seeing a lot of more groups sort of understand how privacy issues intersect with their own lives and with their issues. And so I am still hopeful. And, you know, the data industry is one that relies on new and novel information. They're always looking for more information. So it may feel like, my information's out there, there's nothing I can do about it. But things change and they need new information to be able to feed you ads. I'm not the same person I was 5 years ago. And so being able to kind of change the model of how data collection and use looks is always something that we could do and always something that can make a change.
That's a really positive note to end on. Thanks so much for speaking to us, Hayley.
Thanks for having me.
Hayley mentioned the issue of privacy protections for workers' data in her last answer. And if you'd like to learn more about that, you can listen to our recent episode called The Quantified Worker. If you enjoyed this episode, it would really help us out if you could share it with anyone you think would get something from it. See you next time.